Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Here's what we've got in store for you this morning at 9:30. Calvin Cutler of WCAX will check in with a State House update. We'll give Brady Farkas a run for his money when we talk a little sports. First to Milton for some tubing, then hearing from the three members of the Vermont National Guard who are headed to the Beijing Olympics. And we'll finish at Middlebury College to learn more about Pepin Gymnasium. But we begin today's show discussing restorative justice with Bobby Sand, the founding director of Vermont Law School's Center for Justice Reform. Bobby, thanks for joining us this morning.
Rick, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. We're going to learn about a new partnership between the center and the state's Department for Children and Families. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Bobby Sand a question about restorative justice, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Bobby, what is the Center for Justice Reform at Vermont Law School?
Rick, the center is a hub for innovative academic courses as well as training and conferences to try to infuse Vermont Law School, in addition to its environmental initiatives, with justice reform efforts. Included under the umbrella of the Center for Justice Reform is our really groundbreaking Master of Arts in Restorative Justice, and a subset of that, a professional certificate in restorative justice.
And explain what restorative justice is.
Sure. So restorative justice is a relational response to harm. So instead of looking at what rule or laws were broken and what punishment is expected under the rules or laws, restorative justice asks who was harmed and how can the response center on the harm and the individual who was harmed? How can they have a meaningful voice in shaping the response? And importantly, what obligations to make amends does the responsible party have? So the net goal of a restorative response is a strengthening of individuals, relationships, and communities, and to the maximum extent possible, to healing, rather than having punishment as the explicit goal.
And Bobby, in what kind of cases has this been utilized in Vermont?
Well, so here's really interesting thing, Rick, about restorative justice, or RJ, is it really is a philosophical approach. Yeah. So we oftentimes, I think, unfortunately, think about it as a response only for certain kinds of so-called low-end offenses. But really, philosophically, it applies across the board, centering the harm in the harmed party, giving them a meaningful voice in shaping the response, and asking what obligations the responsible party has to make amends, can and should apply across the board from the most minor harm to very significant harm. It doesn't foreclose a traditional criminal legal response, but it is a different way of getting to a final outcome than we're used to in the traditional punitive approach.
So how did the partnership between your center and the Department for Children and Families, the Family Services Division, come about?
Well, I suppose the most honest answer to that is relationships and hard work and a mutual desire between leaders at the Department for Children and Family and the Center for Justice Reform to find a way to make things work. I should say that DCF, the Department for Children and Families, has a long-standing commitment to restorative justice. And their balance and restorative justice approach, BARGE, has demonstrated their long-standing belief in RJ. And so this really was a very natural partnership to allow DCF employees and contractors to dive a little deeper into the philosophy and history of restorative justice to further infuse their work and the department's work with restorative principles.
And what will this partnership entail?
So what the cohort, the initial cohort is eight folks. What they will do, and this process has started already, is take three online courses through Vermont Law School. And what's really interesting about this is that the DCF employees and contractors become co-learners in these three courses with JD students, law students, and with our master's students.
Wow.
And our online students are situated all over the country and come from a wonderful diversity of background. So this cohort becomes co-learners in those three courses. This coming summer, the cohort will have a special training exclusively for the cohort to help them put theory into practice specifically for their work on behalf of DCF. And ultimately what that really means is on behalf of children and families.
Mm-hmm. What specifically will be taught in the classes that that cohort from DCF will be taking?
Great. So all of them take a foundational course called Origins, Evolution, and Critical Issues in Restorative Justice, or an alternative foundational course called Principles of Restorative Justice. Both of those classes start with the indigenous roots of restorative practice, come all the way up to the present day, and consider some of the critical issues and even shortcomings in RJ. This is a field that needs to engage in self-reflection to make sure it doesn't replicate some of the structures and hierarchies that it's actually trying to dismantle. After they take that initial foundational course, they have all taken a course called New Approaches to Youth Justice. So what are some of the cutting-edge ways that the state can involve itself in a positive fashion with young people and their families? And then the third course, they will have some options. It is certainly my hope that a great many of them take a course called Adversity, Trauma, and Victimization. So many people who graduate from law school as well as from master's programs end up working with people who have been harmed. And yet very few graduate school curriculums look deeply at what does it mean to suffer adverse childhood experiences? What's the lifelong impact of trauma? And so that course, Adversity, Trauma, and Victimization, is an important part of our curriculum and may be the third course that some of this cohort participates in.
The representatives from DCF, the eight who are taking it now, what kinds of cases do they typically handle as part of their work at the department?
Great. And this is a mixed cohort of DCF employees and contractors, all working in the child protection field and in the balanced and restorative justice field. So some of these people work for diversion organizations, and so when young people are charged with crimes, we call those delinquents, and they get referred to diversion, the barge workers will pick up those cases and not only seek input from the harmed party, but work closely with the young person to help them understand what they did and devise ways that the young person can make things right, can make amends. This cohort is also then involved with families to really try to build on existing family strengths to help young people and families stay on a good course. So much of government responses in the justice arena tries to point out what's wrong with people, what their weaknesses are. And this cohort will really be working on how to do an asset-based response. What are the strengths that these young people have, that their families have, that can be bolstered and reinforced to help keep kids on a good path?
Bobby, what will success look like after this partnership is up and running?
Boy, that is a great question, Rick. I think very much we're playing the long game here. Vermont has, on paper and certainly to some extent in practice, expressed an interest in restorative justice. We actually have a state statute that says restorative justice should be at the core of our responses. I think long-term success is that a broad base of DCF employees and contractors have a rock-solid grounding in the history, philosophy, and practices of restorative justice. And if I'm thinking really large-scale, the state of Vermont and its employees and contractors through multiple departments will have a solid grounding in restorative justice. We understand punishment. We have done that for decades. And the time has come to really understand at a deep level this different approach to responding to harm.
So long term, it seems like you're saying that more people from the department will be taking these courses. But do you see then adding to, you know, the three courses so that the program is expanded further?
So I just have a couple of responses to that. Mm-hmm. Our professional certificate is a three-course program. We have a full master's degree in restorative justice. So we are the first law school to also offer a master's degree. The credits toward the certificate count toward the master's, and I certainly am not trying to poach DCF employees and contractors, but if at some point they desire to go on and pursue the master's degree, that is absolutely an option.
Right.
So I guess I'll leave it at that.
Well, why is this partnership something you wanted to see happen between these two entities, Bobby?
Rick, you may remember that I was a prosecutor for a long time.
Yep.
I was the state's attorney in Windsor County for almost 16 years. I spent a lot of time in family court. I've seen a lot of good outcomes through the juvenile justice system, and I've seen some other outcomes that I think really didn't meet the young people and their families where they were. And I know, and this is something that I'm not proud of, a lot of the work I did as a prosecutor was highlighting weaknesses of people. And so, as I mentioned earlier, restorative justice and the work that DCF is doing right now is really looking at an asset-based response. And I am abundantly confident that as more people within DCF and state government appreciate this idea that you can respond to harm and you can address harm without identifying people and labeling people by the worst thing they've done, the harmful thing that they've done. And I think that through RJ Education, the state as a whole can move in the direction of an asset-based response that builds on our strengths while still having people be accountable, while still having people make amends for the harm that they've caused.
Let's take this to a practical level, Bobby, because there are probably people thinking right now, you know, this sounds great, but they're taking a course, but how do they actually incorporate this, what they've learned in these classes, into the work they do for DCF? You know, give us an example of how someone can take what they've learned, these RJ principles, go back to DCF and put it in practice.
Sure. So there is a core practice within the restorative justice field that involves circle dialogue. Very simple. It's not dissimilar from what we probably all did as kindergarten or elementary school kids, where you literally sit in a circle and everybody is given a chance to talk. Mm-hmm. No interrupting. And you make multiple rounds hearing from each of the people involved. Even that simple practice alone, both in the workplace, but also engaging with families, is very, very powerful. We live in a world where those in positions of power tend to have the most voice, and where the state often imposes outcomes on families. So simply using an inclusive dialogue process changes the dynamic. But also then thinking creatively about how young people who cause harm can make amends is also a very powerful learning and corrective tool. So instead of just saying, we're going to put this young person on probation, and they're going to do X number of community service hours, and they're going to get a job and make restitution for some harm that they created, the young people with the RJ-trained DCF workers and the people who have been harmed can creatively think of responses. And very oftentimes, the party who is harmed ends up forming a positive relationship with the young person who caused the harm, and they mutually work to make sure the young person stays out of trouble. So there are both workplace benefits to increased RJ understanding, but also then practical benefits for DCF workers and contractors in how they interact with young people and their families.
Mm-hmm. What type of feedback or input do you hope to get from these representatives of DCF after they go through the classes?
Great question. So I mentioned, Rick, that this cohort will have a hands-on training over the summer. And we are actually meeting in a few weeks, VLS staff, in partnership with the National Center on Restorative Justice. We're holding a circle dialogue with this cohort of DCF workers to find out specifically from them, what is it that you want to learn so that you can better infuse your work with restorative principles and practices. One of the fundamental tenets of RJ is an expression that I really like, and it is nothing about us without us. Mm. And so instead of designing a training for this DCF cohort without input from them, we're actually going to hold a inclusive dialogue process with them so that we can jointly plan what this third hands-on training will look like. Your question makes me realize we really should do a follow-up survey maybe 6 months after they're done to get a sense of whether the courses and the training has had a more lasting impact on them. So thank you for that implicit suggestion.
Did I just help shape this program?
As I have always said, Rick, you are the man.
We got about 30 seconds left, Bobby. Has the center developed any other partnerships in the past similar to what you're doing with DCF?
So I should tell you, with thanks to Commissioner Brown and Deputy Commissioner Radke, Linda James, Lindy Boudreau, and Julie Riley, they brilliantly figured out how some federal money under a program known as 4E could be made available to help fund this. I very much hope that other entities in Vermont, corrections, public safety, the judiciary, will be interested in partnerships. That likely would involve state dollars as compared to having access to federal funds, mm-hmm. but I'm hoping that is not too significant an impediment.
Bobby Sand is the founding director of Vermont Law School's Center for Justice Reform. And to learn more about the Center for Justice Reform at the Vermont Law School, you can visit vermontlaw.edu. Bobby, thanks so much for sharing news of this partnership with us this morning.
I really appreciate the opportunity, Rick. Take care.
All right, you too. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update. Then we'll return to talk with Calvin Cutler of WCAX about what's happening at the State House. And we've got the getaway this afternoon. It is the big boy, 3 hours. That's starting at 1 o'clock. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. As we do every Monday morning, it's time to check in with WCAX Capital Bureau Chief Calvin Cutler. Calvin, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
Calvin, what were the main takeaways from the governor's budget address last week?
Yeah, I mean, I think really the big focus of it was on workforce. I mean, just across the economy, whether we're talking about in childcare, healthcare, you know, social services, the trades, you know, carpentry, everything under the sun, really. I think the governor highlighted the need to make big time investments in our workforce through, you know, education, the CTE centers, through internships, apprenticeships, and others. Certainly, you know, this issue is, it's been a long time coming. It's not necessarily just from the pandemic, though it has made it worse. So the governor, you know, to fund a lot of these initiatives in his $7 billion budget, he proposed using a mix of federal and state cash, but really acknowledging that this huge tranche of federal money that we're experiencing right now through all of the coronavirus aid that Vermont has gotten, certainly it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So he's looking to work with the legislature to pass, you know, a spending plan that includes tax cuts, it includes workforce development, and also investment in our infrastructure as well.
Well, it seems like the legislature, certainly it resonates with them. They're getting some giddy up on a workforce package. So what does this include?
Yeah, so this workforce package, you know, certainly the it's before they pass the budget, you know, the big bill, so to speak, you know, later this year, they're going to be probably this coming week, the Vermont Senate, they are going to be voting on a $360 million package, which really is designed to bolster our workforce and some of our critical needs in the short term. These are, you know, occupations that these investments can't necessarily wait until this coming summer. So there's, you know, $25 million or so to shore up our healthcare workforce, create new ICU beds, you know, retention and bonuses for nurses and staffing. You know, certainly just to get us through the Omicron surge, although cases appear to be dipping off a little bit, you know, the strain on hospitals certainly is very acute. There's also more money for the Vermont Food Bank, another $55 million for housing supports and rental assistance. And then there's also a big pot of money, $50 million to start paying down the state's pension liabilities as well. They're using this budget adjustment as an opportunity to put some money into that as well. So again, this still has to go through the Senate this coming week, and then it will fall on the governor's desk, and we'll see what he thinks about what's in the package. But certainly there's the workforce issues are very acute.
How quickly do they hope to get it to Governor Scott, and are there any snags expected?
Yeah, this one, I mean, they're really, really looking to fast track it. You know, this, you know, originally started off as a $200 million proposal from the governor. The legislature's, you know, beefed it up a little bit, if you will. So, you know, it's looking to pass through the House probably early this week. Not very many tweaks to it, I'd say. And, potentially, you know, to the governor's desk by the end of this week or maybe early next week as well. But, you know, I think the only thing that there's questions about whether the governor will support it in the package is that $50 million pension or putting that $50 million toward the state's $3 billion unfunded pension liability. The legislature, of course, is working on a plan with the unions, and they've come to an agreement of how to make the pension funds sustainable. But, you know, it's still unknown exactly whether the governor will support that or if he'll support paying down $50 million in one-time funds. So we'll have to see. And we'll probably hear from the governor on this tomorrow at his weekly press conference as well, where we're also slated to get an update on the state's coronavirus response.
So that's moving fast. Is there anything happening regarding trying to slow down the COVID case counts?
Yeah, that's another great point as well. You know, certainly there's been a lot of questions and a lot of debate over whether the state should be implementing a statewide mask mandate. You know, the governor has declined to enact a state of emergency, basically saying we have the tools, we have vaccines, we understand how the virus works, we're not in an emergency. But top Democrats in the legislature have really pushed the governor for a mask mandate. They were working on a bill the past couple of weeks in the legislature that would create a temporary statewide mask policy for indoor public spaces. But right now, though, it appears is that bill really won't move forward. It's still in committee in the Senate, meaning, you know, if we were to, you know, if they were to pass it, it would have to go, you know, through the Senate, through the House, it would have to go to the governor's desk. It could be a really drawn out process that could take a few weeks. And, you know, if we know anything about especially Omicron, it spreads very rapidly, and it's always a dynamic changing situation. So the legislature is continuing to put pressure on the governor to really sign an executive order, if you will, for a mask policy. But other than that, though, you know, masking aside, they're still putting lots of big investments into, you know, hospitals and workforce, creating that step down capacity as well, opening up new beds, you know, because masking is a critical component, but it's only one slice of the picture. There's other elements that the state can use to help control the spread of coronavirus.
And am I missing anything? I mean, I don't think Governor Scott is going to sign a bill or come up with an executive order to create a statewide mask mandate.
No, I don't think so. I don't see that as being in the cards. You know, in other jurisdictions and municipalities, you know, nationally, we're starting to see Omicron, you know, the cases are continuing to come down, although hospitalizations are a lagging indicator. Yeah. But that's really what the governor has been looking to is, you know, our hospitalizations and our ICU capacity. And that's really what is driving public policy from his perspective. And, you know, looking at, you know, where we are, hospitalizations are in triple digits, but the ICU capacity as of Sunday was just over 20. I believe it was 22 people in the ICU. And so from the governor's perspective, that's not necessarily a state of emergency territory.
Mm. All right, let's talk about Proposition 5. It's also known as the Reproductive Liberty Amendment. So explain what this says.
Yeah, so this, essentially, in short, this one would enshrine the ability of an individual to seek an abortion. This would solidify that into the state's constitution. And there's some movement on that this week. You know, we heard testimony on it last week, and there's been changing the constitution certainly is a very long process because it's a big deal. And so, you know, the legislature and the executive branch and everybody wants to be sure to get it right. So it's already passed through one body of the legislature. The House is going to be voting on it this session. And this week, of course, we're going to be hearing for the first time public testimony as well on it, where, you know, organizations and individuals and people with lived experiences regarding this issue can testify before House lawmakers. So that's going to be this coming Wednesday from 6 to 8 at the State House, but also virtually as well. But, you know, I think it's just interesting, you know, given where we are with this discussion right now. You know, certainly we have some states that are enacting policies that would restrict access to abortion, such as in Texas and South Dakota, and a few others are looking at that. But then you have other states like Vermont, where the legislature is moving the other way. And of course, all of this comes as, you know, there's questions of whether the Supreme Court will overturn the landmark Roe versus Wade decision. So there's certainly going to be a lot of debate on this topic, and it's going to be really interesting to see play out this week.
And Calvin, as an amendment to the Constitution, if it gets a positive vote in the legislature this session, then what happens next? It's not
then
finished.
Yeah, then good question. Then it goes to the voters. If it passes this session, it will be on the midterm on your ballot this coming November.
All right, Calvin Cutler is the WCAX Capital Bureau Chief. Calvin, thank you so much for joining us this morning with that State House update.
Thank you so much, Rick.
All right, we're going to take a break. Then we'll be back to learn about tubing at Sharp Park in Milton. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Layering, yes, that's one way to cope with Vermont's winters. The other is to get out and play in it. Skiing and riding are fun. Not necessarily for everyone, though. How about snow tubing? With me now to tell us where you can have a great time doing that is Rick Sharp of Sharp Park. Let me try this again. Rick Sharp at Sharp Park at the Sharp Farm in Milton. Rick, look sharp. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks.
It's a lot of sharpness in there.
Yeah. Well, I'm a pretty sharp guy.
You are indeed. Hey, Rick, where and what is Sharp Park?
Sharp Park is the best snow tubing facility in New England. We have the only chute with a launch pad and five sweeping curves for over a quarter-mile run. You can see it on our website. If you go to it, the shots were taken on Christmas Eve of sliding up there. All the other snow tubing facilities are at ski areas where they generally have a couple of 100-yard run down a straight bowling alley coming off of a lift. And this winter, I'm hearing that a lot of them are not open because they have staffing shortages. So the first staff that gets cut at a ski area is the stepchild of the ski area, which is the snow tubing.
But that's your bread and butter. And the website that you mentioned is sharppark.com. So what were people doing this weekend out there?
Oh, they had a blast there this weekend. We had the boat chutes were working top to bottom, not too fast and not too slow. So we had a lot of younger people up as well. The face was working as well. So it was a great. We have great midwinter conditions right now. We will all the way through this week because it's going to be cold, and then this coming weekend should be, you know, the peak of the season. Really good conditions.
How long has Sharp Park been a haven for snow tubing there in Milton?
We built our barn in 2009 and started to rent snow tubes at that point, but we couldn't afford any advertising or anything, so it was just the local kids that came up and went tubing. And it became a little more popular as we went along, but the thing that really did it was the pandemic. You know, in 2021, the winter, everybody wanted to be outside with their family in a safe setting where they didn't have to worry about the spread of COVID, and that was snow tubing. So our business just, you know, tripled, almost quadrupled.
Oh, my. All right, so you have a couple shoots. First, describe the original shoot that you had.
The original shoot had a big bend in it that came around from an old logging road that went up the side of the hill. And the problem was that when it got more packed down later in the day, and the tubes got going faster, they would come out of the chute as it went around that bend. So we had to correct that deficiency. Mm. And after having watched how snow tubes slide down our hill for the last 10 years, I figured out a way to be able to come up with a chute that is higher, longer, and faster, but has the necessary banked curves to prevent the person from coming out of the chute. The problem with snow tubes, of course, well, the good thing and the bad thing. The good thing is that you don't need any skill in a snow tube. You just put your butt in the middle and down you go. Thing is that you don't have any control. You have to have something that channels you down the hill, and that's what the chute does.
So the new one has a launch pad. Is that correct? What exactly is a launch pad for snow tubing?
That's a flat area where people can line their snow tubes up to, you know, 7 or 8 of them if they want at the same time tied together. And then there's a steep drop off the edge. So the first couple go off the edge, they drag the rest of them off, and down they go through the chute a quarter of a mile. You can see it in our new TV ad that's coming out, or came out this last weekend, WCAX.
Oh, my goodness. And is there an age limit or anything on either chute?
Nope. We have, well, on the chutes, the original chute now is designed more for kids down to probably 2 to 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But even children younger than that can slide on the lower slopes down below. And then kids that are 7 to 8, they'll want to get up into sun of chute. And all the way up to the launch pad, so they have a ball.
And this is all tubes, no kind of sleds or anything like that, right?
We allow people, the locals, to bring sleds up if they want to. You know, it costs them $10 a car for you got to plow the place out, you know. And we recommend that they bring helmets as well. All kids under 18 have to have helmets on. Adults can make their own decision, but we allow sleds up there. The chutes are designed for the snow tubes. So if you're really good on a sled and you know what you're doing, you can make it all the way from the top to the bottom on one of those round saucers. But if you don't know what you're doing on a saucer, you're not going to survive the chute. It'll eat you alive.
Now, when are you open, Rick, over there at the Sharp Park?
Weekends and school holidays. Through the end of February. The school holiday is the last week of February. We get really, really busy that week.
All right, so people have about 4 or 5 more weekends to get there. Are reservations needed to come to Sharp Park?
No, we have 60 snow tubes, and they're turning over all the time during the day. You know, some people last, we don't have put a time limit on the snow tube like a lot of facilities do.
Right.
We let the hill wear you out. So there's some people that can only last out there for 30 minutes. But there's others that go, you know, for up to 3 hours, you know, but you got to be able to walk back up the hill each time.
Mm-hmm.
So that that kind of limits how long you're using the tube. So they turn it over all the time.
Oh, good. And I understand that if you are bringing a larger group, it would be helpful to know in advance for you.
That's right, because we'll mark it down that somebody's coming at, you know, 11 o'clock in the morning with 8 people, and we'll make sure that we have the tube set aside for you.
Mm-hmm. And then how do people know if you're open on any given weekend, if you have, you know, the good snow down the chutes to take care of the tubers?
We are very subject to conditions. So, obviously, you know, you need to check our website before you come up there. Don't just come up. So we post daily on what conditions are like up there. Right now we have great midwinter conditions, but you know you get a rainstorm that comes through that changes things completely.
Yeah, all natural snow, no snowmaking.
That's right, all natural snow.
All right, and then what happens, Rick, at Sharp Farm when the tubing festivities end for the year? What else do you do there at Sharp Farm?
We teach paragliding during the summertime. We have Segway tours around the farm. And, of course, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, we sell choose and cut Christmas trees at Sharp Farm. So it's a multi-use property, 101 acres, that we're trying to preserve for public use forever rather than another 10-lot subdivision in southern Milton.
Mm, I love it. And tell us about the paragliding. That sounds interesting.
That's where I bought the property, actually. I thought we were going to teach hang gliding there. Hang gliders didn't work because we have a sloping landing zone. So I was very fortunate that the year after I bought it, and the property in 1984, paragliders were invented. Paragliders land much more like a helicopter. They're 15 feet overhead, so they don't get into ground effect. And they work terrific at Cobble Hill. So we've been teaching paragliding at Cobble Hill since 1992. We added all the other things as we went along, and now it turns out that snow tubing looks like it's going to be the major attraction at Cobble Hill, the one that brings in the most income. No doubt about that.
Isn't that incredible? Also, in the warmer months, people can have events there. Tell us about the events that get hosted at your farm.
We have weddings there as well. We're going to be expanding the deck next year, putting a cover over that so we don't have to use a tent outside. But we built a beautiful barn on the property, 2009. It's a post and beam, 30-foot high ceiling on one end, 16 on the other, and very distinctive. Unfortunately, this winter, like last winter, we've kept the barn closed because of the pandemic,
right.
And we're doing all the snow tubes out on the deck. But we still have coffee, hot chocolate snacks and stuff available on the deck as well. And we have a number of snow tubing birthday parties this year.
Oh, my. So how big an event, how many people, like a wedding, would you be able to host there at the farm?
Up to about 120 to 150, depending upon the setup of the tents there.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's Rick Sharp of Sharp Park in Milton at the Sharp Farm. To learn more, you can go to sharppark.com. Rick, I want to thank you for being on with us this morning.
Well, thank you very much for putting us on. That's terrific.
Sure.
We love to have locals come up and go sliding. And we've got a terrific winter going on.
So I know. Perfect. Right now, you're kind of in a sweet spot with the snow and the temps. Should be great.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Take care. News is next, and then we're going to meet a trio that have been playing in the snow. So they love it so much that they've qualified for the Winter Olympics. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Vermont has a long, impressive history of sending folks from the Green Mountain State to the Winter Olympics, and the next Winter Games are just around the corner in Beijing, China. Among those with a Vermont connection headed there are three members of the Vermont National Guard competing in the biathlon. Joining me now is Deidre Irwin of Jericho. Deidre, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hello.
Hello there. We also have Sean Daugherty of Center Conway, New Hampshire, who's headed to his third Olympic Games. Sean, great to have you here.
Thanks for having us on.
You're welcome. And then we have Leif Nordgren of Heinsberg, who also competed in the 2014 and 2018 Winter Games. Leif, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right. Now, listeners, if you want to ask our Olympians about biathlon or going to the Olympics, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Deidre, explain what biathlon is.
Well, biathlon is a combination of Nordic skiing and precision shooting. We ski any distance from, at least on the women's side, 6K to 15K, and shoot prone and standing with our modified 22 and try to clean all our targets and ski fast.
And, yeah, so what are there different events that you're going to be participating in when you're there?
Yeah, we have in a couple different events. We have individual events, and then we also have team relay events. So for me, I'll hopefully be competing in at least the individual and the sprint, and if I qualify for the pursuit, and then we also have the gender women's relay. But depending on how everybody's doing, we also have mixed relays where we have both male and female genders. So anywhere from 3 to 6 races, I think, for all the athletes is possible.
Wow. Sean, do you know what you'll be competing in yet in Beijing?
It's very similar. We haven't picked our mixed relay team yet. We'll do that much closer to the actual competitions. And, I'm hoping to go for all 6 races. That would be my goal.
Well, I hope so. Now, Leif, is there a circuit that you're all competing on right now in the run-up to the Olympics?
Yes. So generally our typical World Cup season goes from the last week or two of November and then extends all the way through the third week of March. So we just finished a competition in Northern Italy in Antolz, Italy. And then we have about a week long training camp here before we'll depart to Beijing on Saturday.
And how are you all doing? Deidre, how are you doing on the circuit right now, on the World Cup circuit?
I've had a handful of personal bests this year. In individual races, I scored my first World Cup points early in the season. And just this past weekend, our women's relay got 5th place, which is the best result that we have had in the modern biathlon era. So that was super exciting and just, you know, a couple places off the podium. So we're really trying to push for that coming up, coming into the Olympics.
That's outstanding. Sean, how about you? How are you doing?
I've been a little more up and down. It hasn't been the smoothest start to the season for me, but my skiing is coming around, which is great time to have that improving. And, hoping to take this break to refocus and be ready for China.
Leif, how's your season going?
pretty bad so far, I would say. I've struggled with sickness a lot. This year, just not COVID or anything. Our team has been pretty lucky in that regard. But, I've had just a couple little upper respiratory infections and things like that. So, like Sean said, I hope that my skiing is slowly starting to come around here. You know, there's still another 10 days or so to go before the first competition. So there's a little time still to get back in shape.
Yep. Now, Leif, how are you all able to balance the responsibilities you have with the National Guard and be able to train and compete internationally like you do?
Well, so the three of us are pretty lucky. We have the National Guard biathlon team is based out at Camp Ethan Allen out in Jericho. So we're all able to train there basically every day. The three of us here on this call are all in different units within the National Guard. But our units are very lenient with us in allowing us to obviously travel, you know, for 5 months all winter. And then when we're back in Vermont in the summer, you know, we do try to put in as much time as possible with our units to kind of, you know, obviously keep a good relationship with them. But yeah, they're very, very supportive of us as athletes to let us basically disappear for 5 months at a time to come over here and race.
Well, Deirdre, this sport, biathlon, really is much more popular in Scandinavian and other European countries than it is in the U.S. So how did you come to the sport?
Actually, through a current teammate of mine. Her name's Joanne Reed. In 2017, when I was thinking about retiring from professional Nordic skiing, because I did that for a couple years after college, she reached out to me and told me about the biathlon program based out of Lake Placid, New York. And so I flew out and did a talent ID camp, and they taught me how to shoot a rifle. And I kind of already had the skiing background, and it was that was it. From there, I fell in love with it. And, you know, from there, I got introduced to the National Guard, and that program really helped me, you know, grow as an athlete in biathlon, and now we're here 4 years later.
And we got you to move to Vermont, right? You're in Jericho now?
Got me to move to Vermont. No, sneaky.
It's how we do things here.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's how you keep your population up.
That's right. But you come from a nice, we'll call it cool weather state of Wisconsin, so it didn't take too much of an adjustment. Sean, what is it that you...
Oh, yeah, it wasn't too bad.
Right? Yeah. Sean, what is it that you enjoy about competing in biathlon?
I really enjoy especially the head-to-head competition aspect of biathlon. It's something that really drew me to the sport. I really enjoy those moments, especially, you know, either on the range or on the course when it's kind of, you know, two or three people just duking it out to see, you know, who can perform the best in that moment. And that's something I think makes it really exciting to watch. And also as an athlete, it's something that you always look forward to on every competition day.
Leif, how difficult is it to excel at the two components of biathlon?
Oh, that's a very deep question.
I asked the deepest of questions.
right. Obviously, you know, shooting and skiing are two completely opposite sports. So, you know, one of the things that helps us the most is just the amount of training that we do in the summer. So, you know, all of us as athletes spend probably 600 to 700 hours of just physical training throughout the summer and fall months. And then probably an additional 300 to 400 hours of just shooting training throughout the year too. So yeah, basically the way you excel is just to train a lot and train how you race, and train, mentally, you know, for those tough race situations that, you know, you might encounter if you go to a world championships or an Olympic Games or something like that.
And then how, you know, difficult is it to aim and shoot a rifle when it's freezing temperatures and now sometimes you're standing, but sometimes you're prone, you're laying on the ground to shoot. You know, how difficult is it to maintain your aim and shoot a rifle competently after you're winded? I mean, I really want people to know this is not the easiest of sports.
Right. So yeah, that's actually going to be a big thing in Beijing. From what, you know, none of us have actually been there before. Mm-hmm. Our pre-Olympic competitions got canceled last year. But yeah, one of the things that we've always heard is, I think the average temperature for our competition venue this time of year is like 4 degrees Fahrenheit or something like that. So, and quite windy also. So yeah, temperature and wind is going to be a huge factor for the Olympics. I honestly always think that North Americans, you know, U.S. and Canadian athletes handle the cold better than sometimes a lot of Europeans do, because it's European winters can be quite mild, actually. Mm. So, yeah, I think it's just, you know, all of us come from northern states originally. So we're just a little better at maybe handling cold conditions than some athletes are.
Mm-hmm. Deidre, what kind of rifle are you guys using in this competition?
We have a modified 22 that was made by Anschutz Fortner in Germany. I think most of us have that brand. There's maybe only one other brand on the circuit, but it's not as popular. But it's just a straight bolt 22 long rifle.
And when you are you stop at one of the ranges, how many shots do you have to fire and then take off?
So you have 5 bullets. And 5 targets. So you either stop and lay down to do prone, or you stop and shoot standing. And yeah, you have to try to hit all 5 with just 5 bullets.
And is it more important to ski quickly or shoot accurately when you're competing in biathlon?
That is always the question. something I learned very, very difficultly switching over from Nordic skiing to biathlon, because when I was a Nordic skier, you kind of just go right off the line. You red line, and it's whoever can hold on the longest
right. And
the fastest and get to the finish line first wins. But in biathlon, you have to have a little bit more of a finesse to it. You have to keep under control for, you know, all the laps going into the range to make sure that you can shoot. And then it's not really until the last lap, after you've done your last shooting, that you really just go for it and redline and try to, you know, make it to the finish line first. But it's, you know, it really depends. You can be a really, really fast Nordic skier on this circuit and maybe miss a couple and still get on the podium. But it's usually the people who are more consistent at both, you know, high level skier and a very accurate shooter. Those are the people that, you know, you'll see consistently in the top 10.
Yeah.
It's not either or.
Sean and Leif, you both have competed in the last 2 Winter Olympics. I'll ask you first, Sean, what have you learned from competing in the Olympic Games?
The Olympics is a special show, special event. And, you know, a lot of what I learned going there as a younger athlete was how to manage all of the other things that are going on outside of competition, whether it's being in a new environment and dealing with lots of media stuff and lots of other things that are kind of, you know, just you're under an extra microscope at the Olympics. And that's something that takes some getting used to, but I'm more prepared for this time. The other thing is, I think we're going to be dealing with very similar conditions in China to what we had previously in Korea, where it's going to be windy. And I think that's going in, knowing, you know, being more prepared for that is going to be helpful.
I mean, Leif, is it just another stop on the World Cup tour for athletes, or, you know, do the Olympics have a certain cachet? And like Sean said, you know, you're under a more intense microscope when you get there.
Yes and no. So one of the big, well, obviously this is, you know, the U.S. Olympic team. So I think with any U.S. Olympic team, there's a huge amount of, you know, media coverage that comes with being on this team. So that's one kind of extra thing that we have to deal with for the Olympics that maybe we don't deal with so much for, you know, just your everyday World Cup competition. So I will say that one of the big things that we kind of get harped on a lot by the media is that biathlon is the only Winter Olympic sport that has never won a medal in the Olympics. So, yeah, that's one thing that definitely puts a lot of pressure on us as athletes. But you know, biathlon is a very big, mentally challenging sport. So even though there is extra pressure at the Olympics, you still have to treat those competitions like any other competition. Biathlon is not a sport where, you know, you can just wake up the morning of the Olympics and decide, oh, I'm going to really go out there and do something special today. When you have that mindset in biathlon, that's where you're going to get yourself into trouble shooting. And, you know, you will often end up having a poor competition compared to what if you just go out and do kind of your regular job.
I won't harp on that fact, Leif.
No worries.
But I do love that you use the phrase, your everyday World Cup competition, because you are an elite athlete competing at the highest level in this sport. And so it may seem every day to you, but certainly not to the rest of us. Deirdre, are you hearing from, those who have been there before about what you'll experience at the Olympics? Have they given you some tips or pointers?
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of tips and pointers about kind of how to deal with, you know, media and stuff like that. Because, you know, almost immediately after they announce the team, you just get flooded with interview requests or, you know, people you haven't heard from in 10 years trying to like say, hey, remember me, you know, stuff like that. So, but like as for going to the Olympics, I think this year is going to be, you know, really different for everyone with all of the COVID regulations. It's not going to be the normal, you know, get there and, you know, just be able to hang out with everybody and meet everyone. We're kind of, you know, going to get there, stay in our bubble, go to our rooms and avoid humans. So it's going to be a little different. You know, it's not going to be the normal like outfitting and everything like that. They're just going to send us a box of stuff. So wow. I think in general, like I've gotten a lot of great advice about media and kind of how to handle that pressure. But I think it's going to be kind of a new experience for everyone going to, you know, Beijing Olympics during COVID.
And Deirdre, have you had those same kind of protocols on the World Cup tour, staying in a bubble or not?
Yeah, we have. Earlier this season, we, you know, opened our bubble up a little bit. You know, we were able to have, you know, athletes and then techs. And now we're kind of more on the two-person roommate bubble list again, really trying to avoid not just COVID, but common colds and just any little thing that can happen leading up to the Olympics. So the past month, we've gotten pretty strict about, you know, what rooms we can be in, mask wearing, and all that stuff, kind of gone back to the really strict rules that we had last year during, you know, the full COVID season.
Mm-hmm. All right, Sean, RC emailed, wants to know, when you get to those, the shooting range, how far are the targets that you're shooting at?
Targets are 50 meters away, or 163 feet.
Wow. All right, let's take a call next from Mark in Middlesex. Hi, Mark, go right ahead.
Yeah, hi. I have a couple teenage boys that are excellent shooters and real good skiers, too. I'm wondering if it's possible to be a part of the team and not join the guard. Thank you much.
All right, thanks, Mark. Leif, you want to answer that?
Yes, sure. So it is definitely possible to be part of the team and not be a member of the military. So it's just the three of us that are members of the military, and there's five other athletes that are regular civilian athletes. So the best way that I know of in Vermont is there's a couple of different programs in Vermont. There's the one in Jericho, where we train at every Tuesdays and Thursdays. There's a open public shooting session that really anyone, you know, you don't have to have any prior shooting experience at all, I think.
And the club is called the Ethan Allen Biathlon Club.
All right.
Camp Ethan, something like that. Ethan Allen Biathlon Club. And it's, yeah, local civilians who, you know, use the range, and there's actually a youth and junior program already, like a high school program that has coaching. And so I think it's, you know, a pretty small club fee to come try it out and and, you know, experience biathlon with a bunch of the other local kids that are, you know, getting into it. So that's one option. And also Craftsbury has a junior program and also a senior program that even some of the other athletes from this team are part in Craftsbury, Vermont at the outdoor center. I don't know about any other.
Mark, you've got two ready-made members of those teams. So I hope you can get to either Camp Ethan Allen or Craftsbury with your sons so they can start on biathlon. Sounds like they're perfect for this. All right, we have just about a minute left. So, Sean, what are you looking forward most to being part of the Olympics coming up in Beijing?
That's an open-ended question. That's tough. It's always a special feeling to be a part of the team, and it's cool, you know, although, like you just said, we'll be kind of more restricted due to COVID. It is cool to meet other people from other sports that we never really crossed paths with.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to competing because it's going to be a place that none of us have ever been before, and I think that's really going to allow for some opportunity for, you know, people to have some great races when it counts, and I think that's it's really exciting for me.
And Deidre, when do you all take off for China?
We will leave January 29th, and we're flying out of Milan, Italy, to Beijing, China.
All right. That's Deidre Irwin of Jericho, Sean Daugherty of Center Conway, New Hampshire, and Leif Nordgren of Hinesburg, all members of the Vermont National Guard and the U.S. Olympic team, and they'll be competing in Beijing in biathlon. I want to thank you all for joining us this morning, and best of luck in China.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. All right, we're going to take a break for CBS News. We'll get an update. Then we'll be back to talk about Middlebury College's Pepin Gymnasium. And coming up this morning at 11 on WDEV, it's Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're now in an era when sports venues get named for corporations and the monikers get changed every few years as the sponsorship deals lapse. At one time, college arenas and stadia were named for someone who did something outstanding or an alum who contributed enough to get the building built. Where I went to school in Dayton, Ohio, the old football stadium was named for College Hall of Fame coach Harry Bojan, who played on the same Notre Dame football team as Newt Rockne. The Gut at UVM is named for Albert Lovejoy Gutterson of Springfield, Vermont, who won gold in the 1912 Summer Olympics for the long jump. So what about Pepin Gymnasium on the campus of Middlebury College? Carl Lindholm recently explained who the Pepin of Pepin Gymnasium is in his column in the Addison Independent, and he joins us now to explain. Carl, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a Middlebury College sports question, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Where did the Middlebury Panthers play before Pepin Gymnasium was built, Carl?
Well, even before we start that, Rick, at colleges like Middlebury, there will be no corporate names on any buildings. It's against policy, if you will.
Good.
So what's interesting about all of our sports venues are named after people. And all of them, it turns out, everyone except Pepin, and I'll get to your question in just a second. Everyone but Pepin is named after somebody I actually knew. And I never knew Pepin. But anyway, we've had only two gymnasiums on the whole campus, or in our whole history of sports, indoor sports, basketball, for example. Only two. In 1912, a gymnasium was built, McCullough Gym. And that was the gymnasium until 1949, when Memorial Gymnasium was built. It was actually a Navy recreation center during World War II in Sampson, New York. And Middlebury College bought it. They had raised $700,000 to purchase it. It was dismantled and transported back to Middlebury and reassembled on the college campus. And it was Memorial Gymnasium, which was still around now. It's the basketball court is still there. And the old hockey arena, Nelson Arena, we have a new hockey arena, Kenyon Arena, but the Nelson part of the field house is used for indoor tennis and other indoor sports.
Mm. Boy, that movement of the building is kind of like old Colt Stadium where the Houston Colt 45s played. That was dismantled and then reassembled down in Mexico for a team down there, and I think it's still being used. So what was Memorial Gymnasium like back when it was first built in 1949? What did it have?
Well, it was pretty crude. It was actually the gym where I played in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And it had bleachers on one side. It had stands, grandstand on one side, but not on the other side. There were two adjacent courts, pretty plain, but it was a nice building. In the lobby of the building, it was called Memorial Gymnasium in honor of those Middlebury students who died in World War II. Mm. And there was a lobby between the hockey side of the building and the basketball side of the building. And in that lobby was a beautiful, is a beautiful, it's still there, but it's so rarely has anybody in it because we have a different entry to the facilities now that we have this a new field house, actually Virtue Field House. But from floor to ceiling, a beautiful with gold inlay inscriptions of all the names of the students who died in World War II.
Hmm.
And it's kind of I find it unfortunate that is so rarely seen these days. I thought maybe there was something we could even maybe move it somewhere. But anyway, it was Memorial Fieldhouse to honor those soldiers who died in World War II.
Now, you played, you got there in the, what's that, Carl?
Basic affair. It was a gym with some stands and, you know, adequate. But it's been renovated substantially twice.
Yeah.
Since then.
Well, we'll talk about that. Now, you showed up in Middlebury in the mid-60s playing basketball and baseball. When were you there?
63 to 67. I grew up playing. I was, that era, if you identified as an athlete, you played whatever sport was in season.
Right.
But my favorite sports were basketball. Though I grew up in Maine, I was perhaps because of basketball, I was never particularly attracted to outdoor sports in the winter. You know, it's cold in Maine in the winter.
Yes, it is.
And also, when I came to school in Vermont, I found it cold over here, too. And when I was in the basketball gym, it was warm. And even now, in my dotage, I go to a lot of basketball games.
Yes, you do.
It's warm in the gym. I like it there.
Well, as a student playing basketball at Middlebury, how much time did you spend in the building during those years?
Well, a lot. the gym, I think if you like basketball, I love to play basketball. I love to study baseball. Baseball, you need kind of more organization than you do in basketball. You can play one-on-one in basketball. You can just, if you can find a gym that's open, or in my case, even in the winter, shooting baskets in the yard, but you can go shoot baskets. It's just a nice diversion. You can play one-on-one, two-on-two. Pick up basketball is about as much fun as it's possible to have in informal sports. So I was in the gym a lot. Our practices started then, and I think they do in Division I still. Our practices at Middlebury in Division III started on November 1st. But we had an official practice every day, perhaps not on Sundays, but from October 15th to the middle of February. And then if you wanted to be better at the game, you had to go down to the gym and practice. And the other, I just always found that if I had any anxiety in life or was upset or sad about something.
Yeah.
You know, the gym was a sanctuary. You could go to the gym and play some hoops, and your troubles would seem to evaporate for a little while. So, as a younger man, I really enjoyed playing informal basketball, playing in adult men's leagues, which were very common then, not as common now. So, it's been a basketball. I'm not terribly. I wish I were better at it. Gladwell has this thing: if you do something for 10,000 hours, you become expert at it. But I kind of defied that. I shot a lot more than that at baskets. But anyway, so it's a kind of sanctorum for me and for a lot of people. I have a younger son, Peter, who lives in Burlington now, and he's an avid pickup player.
Yeah. Well, when did you start attending mid-games as a fan?
Well, I'm old, Rick. Somebody the other day said, I knew I would get old, but I didn't know it would happen this fast. I'm sort of in that category. I was away from Middlebury. I graduated in 67. I was away from Middlebury for 9 years. And then I came back to work at the college. And I've been here ever since, so I have over half a century at Middlebury College. So that's a lot of time seeing events or playing in that particular gymnasium.
Yeah, how many games do you think you've attended watching there at Pepin?
Well, nowadays they play 25 games a season. Half of them are at home. So you could do, I don't know, half of 25, 12, 10, 10 to 12, that's 10 to 12 games for 50 years.
Yeah.
That's all I can't do that.
600 games total played and watched in Pepin.
Yeah.
Is it possible, Carl Lindholm, that you've spent more time in that building than just about anyone else?
Well, we've had coaches who have other offices there. Our current basketball coach has been here for 25 years, and so he spent a lot of time there. I spent a lot of time there. Perhaps as somebody not employed in that particular in athletics, probably as much as anybody else. that's for sure.
Yeah. All right.
And, the irony is The irony is I can't go in it now.
Oh, no kidding! The game's closed right now.
The college is a bubble again.
Oh, my goodness.
So I used to tell people that I own a few acres of land in Cornwall, Vermont, but I own 350 acres in town. I taught here for a long time. And
yeah.
So my places that I like to hang out were the library and the field house. I like to walk in the field house during the winter, and I spent a year and a half without being able to go into those facilities.
Oh, that stinks. Okay, so the Memorial Fieldhouse, built in 1949, still what is Pepin today. But when I go in there, Carl, it seems newish, beautifully lit. So it has been refurbished. When was the first time that work was done on the Fieldhouse?
Well, 1984, Art Pepin. Provided most of the funds for a major comprehensive renovation of the facility. It was much in need of that, as you might imagine. He came through with a major gift that provided that, made that possible.
What do we know about Art Pepin as the Middlebury student and athlete?
Well, some people knew something about him. The people in development knew enough about approach him for the gift, but I didn't know anything about him. And as I mentioned at the very outset, I had personal relationships with quite modest with those members of the board of trustees who put their names on buildings. But, and I had never heard of Art Pepin. I had never heard mention of Art Pepin. And over the years, actually writing this column in the Independent, and just out of personal interest and attachment to a basketball team, I know a lot about the basketball history, and never heard Art Pepin's name even mentioned in that history. I couldn't have picked Art Pepin out of a lineup, and so I actually took egotistical offense at the fact that this gym was named after a person who had no relationship to basketball. And I sometimes bristled when people said, are you going to Pepin tonight for a game? I'd say, well, I guess I am, but it's not Pepin to me, you know? And so I wanted to look into, I thought, that's in that. Who is this guy anyway?
Mm-hmm.
And I found out that he has a very interesting history. So I think he's legitimately attached to that facility. He had a great love for his alma mater, Middlebury, and he was a terrific athlete when he was a student here, though interestingly not in basketball.
Well, he's a native Vermonter, correct?
Yes. Well, that was it. I thought here I am, a skeptic and a cynic, and I say, well, he's a rich guy who wanted his name on a building. And that is true. he was. But he made his money before we get to his background as a young person. He made his money selling beer. He had the Anheuser-Busch distributorship in Tampa, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
He became a personal friend of Gussie Bush, August Bush, the founder of Bush Beer. And Bush used to vacation in St. Petersburg, Florida, right opposite Tampa. Bush awarded the Tampa distributorship to Art Pepin. Pepin used to say, I'm in the business of making friends. He loved to entertain and he loved to sponsor events, and very outgoing guy, made a lot of money. But what was most interesting to me is he was a Vermonter, and a Vermonter of very interesting and humble beginnings. He was born in Newport, Vermont. His dad was French-Canadian, a Quebecois. His mom was from Holland, Vermont. His dad worked on the railroad. His mom took in laundry and cleaned homes. He had seven siblings. He was the second youngest of eight children. There's one of the little bios that I read said there were eight children and five beds. And all the kids had to work growing up. And Art used to work in the summers from age 10 as a caddy at the Newport Country Club, a nine-hole golf course. And one of the golfers who took a liking to Art was a woman named Leonie Hayes from New Jersey. They summered in Newport. And at one point she said to Art, are you thinking about college? And he said, no, well, we can't afford college. I'm thinking about working for a living and not going to school at that level. And she said, she changed his whole perspective. She said, I think you should think about college. And if you qualify for college, I'll pay for it.
Wow.
Which she did. She paid for Art Pepin to come to Middlebury College. And he came to Middlebury College with his best friend from Newport High, a fellow that skiers will remember, his name, Bobo Sheehan, the legendary Middlebury ski coach.
Yeah.
Daughter Patty Sheehan was a great golfer.
Oh,
and,
wow.
So he came to Middlebury by virtue of the funds provided by Mrs. Hayes, who remained his lifelong friend. He predeceased her, and they were friends for life, and he developed a scholarship at Middlebury in her name.
Wow. Carl, let me get this call in because Rick Norcross is calling. I know he's had experience in the Tampa Bay area. Rick, go right ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. And, Carl, you're right spot on talking about Art. I was lucky enough to meet Art and become friends with him when I was playing in the Tampa area with my band. And Art actually sponsored my band for almost 10 years at the Florida State Fair. And I even played the Super Bowl party for Budweiser in 1984. And he was just a wonderful, warm, gregarious is the right word, fella. His wife, Polly, is from Vermont, I believe, Charlotte. And at one point, Art bought the golf club over in Westport. He owned that after he had pretty much retired. His son Tom also went to Middlebury, and I just really appreciate you talking about Art. What a wonderful man. Thank you.
Oh, Rick, thanks so much for that call. Wow, there's another little connection to Art Pepin. I do want to ask you, Carl, getting back to you for a bit, about your career at Middlebury. Do you remember your record, your senior year there at as a Panther?
Yeah, I remember it.
How'd you guys do that year?
We won one game my senior year.
That was a rough season for you guys.
Let me tell you, you know, I could give you 3 hours on this.
On a 1-22 season.
They weren't that bad.
Really?
Our second to last game, we lost by 2 points. We lost by 2 points to UVM.
Wow.
It was one of those years.
Of the
years I was there, it was the best team in terms of even teamwork and camaraderie, but in terms of talent, our coach had adjusted the schedule to because we had began to accommodate in our weakness, playing a lot of Canadian schools. I'm still friends with those guys. We loved our coach.
Yep.
We had some very good games. The one team we beat was Brandeis. We beat him by 16. They were coached by Casey Jones.
Wow.
So we were star-crossed. But, you know, I'll never talk to you again for bringing that up.
I'm sorry about that, Carl.
Vermont had a coach named Fuzzy Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And he was retiring that year. And so on Fuzzy Evans night, they said, we'll play against Middlebury up at UVM. They beat us by 5.
Wow.
I thought Fuzzy Evans was going to have a heart attack. He was going to lose the night of he was being honored.
Oh, man. Carl Lindholm has been a student, an athlete, a professor, and a dean at Middlebury College. He's been writing a sports column in the Addy Indy since 1999, and he's an expert on Negro League baseball, a subject. Carl, I hope that we can have you back on as the season gets started, if it does get started this year. Carl, I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, I'll come back if you don't ask me about my basketball record. But if you ask me, I'll come back, yes.
All right.
Thanks.
All right, thanks, Carl. All right, that's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we discuss kosher maple cream and we meet WDEV All-Star Roland LaJoy.